Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Peking, an epic novel of 20th century China by Anthony Gray. Narrated by Cindy Kay. Art always serves beauty. And beauty is the joy of possessing form. And form is the key to all organic life, since no living thing can exist without it. So every work of art, including tragedy, witnesses to the joy of existence. Boris Pasternak, Dr. Zhivago. Prologue. Manchester, 1921. Because our eyes are blue, most Chinese believe we can see into the ground to a depth of 3 feet. The sunburned features of the tall, quiet-spoken Lancashire missionary relaxed in an amused smile. They think we use that little trick to discover gold in China. But for some strange reason, they're also convinced that we blue-eyed folk can't see through clear water. The missionary's smile broadened. His teeth gleamed white in a lean, handsome face that had been burnished to the color of bronze by many years of Asian sun and wind. And the expression lent a temporary radiance to the drab church hall in which an audience of several hundred devout Mancunians were listening intently to his every word. They call us Yang Guizhe, foreign devils, and they say we murder Chinese children in our missionary orphanages so that we can use their intestines to turn lead into silver. They say the high spires of the churches we're building in China are annihilating their spirits of the air, that the mine shafts and railways being constructed by British engineers are destroying the benevolent influence of terrestrial dragons coiled deep beneath the earth. Near the back of the hall, Jacob Kellner shifted suddenly on one of the hard wooden benches where he sat between his parents. Still innocent blue eyes, inherited from his Swiss-born father, narrowed in concentration as he dragged his fascinated gaze away from the heroic figure of the missionary to stare fiercely at the coarse-grained planks of the floor. With all the force his 10-year-old mind could muster, he willed his sense of sight to penetrate the scuffed wood and enter the earth beneath. Who could tell? Thought Jacob excitedly. Perhaps terrestrial English dragons, unknown to anyone, lay coiled in the earth beneath industrial Manchester. Perhaps it was their benevolent influence that had attracted the forest of cotton mill chimneys to that region of northern England in the first place. Perhaps the thick black smoke that belched daily from the mill chimneys came in reality from these fire-breathing beasts. It was the mills and the industrial prosperity they promised which years before had lured his father westward across Europe from the impoverished canton of Zurich to seek work in the city as a textile engineer. Perhaps, thought Jacob, those same magic dragons had prompted the meeting between his father and his gentle, artistic English mother while she was teaching the new techniques of embroidering by machinery in the mills. His father's big-boned hands, grimed permanently with oil in their creases, rested in his lap at the edge of Jacob's vision. He was a taciturn, mild-mannered man who had started attending the nonconformist church in a cobbled back street of Mossside merely to please his wife. But now, like all the other rapt listeners around him, his faith had become a vital source of refreshment that helped him endure the hardships of life in the mean, dingy streets that had grown up around the mills. Notorious for its constant rain and raw fogs, Manchester was excelling its reputation even on that midsummer Sunday of 1921. Steady, soot-laden rain was drenching the cobbles outside the hall, and a leaden sky pressed against the dirty windows. If only these invisible underground dragons could influence the weather, thought Jacob. If only the sun would burn down on Manchester, as it obviously did on China, to weather the pale, gaunt faces around him, and make them resemble that of the tall, energetic missionary who was undertaking a short speaking tour during his first home leave in 10 years. They call the new telegraph wires we've put up in the remote interior regions of China iron snakes. When rainwater rusts on them and drips to the ground, they say it is the blood of the dying spirits of the air. If there is a famine or a drought, they blame foreign missionaries in all our works, saying we have outraged those spirits. So great efforts, you see, are still required to overcome this terrible ignorance and spread the word of God through the length and breadth of China. Jacob raised his eyes to find the missionary slipping on a wide-sleeved, embroidered Chinese long gown. Smiling again, he held up a black satin cap with an artificial pigtail attached to the back, then pulled it into place to cover his steel-gray hair. Clasping his hands together within the sleeves, he inclined his head and shoulders in a mock bow, transforming himself instantly into the likeness of a Chinese mandarin. They say all Christians are cannibals, because we like to eat the body and drink the blood of our God. They sometimes draw pictures of our Lord on the cross as a crucified pig. All this stirs up hatred against missionaries, and so it is no secret that many brave men and women have been martyred in China. So when you travel in the mountains, it's sometimes wise to wear Chinese clothes like these. Then the bandits hiding on the mountaintops, with luck, will mistake you for a Chinese. If not, you might be robbed or kidnapped, or worse. The missionary's face had become stern. Now his voice deepened abruptly, taking on a commanding tone. But whenever a missionary dies, another must be ready to step forward and take his place. Volunteers are needed to dedicate their lives to that vast, unfortunate country. Otherwise, China will never be saved. Jacob stared fixedly at the exotically clad figure. As the missionary paused to survey his audience, the 10-year-old boy fancied that the steady blue gaze rested on him alone for a second or two before moving on. After removing the long gown, the missionary began speaking again. But this time, Jacob neither heard the words nor saw his shabby surroundings. In his mind's eye, he was surveying a distant land of towering mountain ranges, thronged with writhing dragons and surging hordes of Chinese bandits armed to the teeth. Through the chaos and confusion, he himself was striding, proud, straight-backed, and bronzed like the missionary by the merciless Asian sun. Braving all dangers, he was seeing into the ground to a depth of 6 feet on every side. He was finding gold everywhere without effort, and turning lead into silver at will. Bandits and dragons retreated on all sides in whichever direction he advanced, powerless to prevent him from saving China virtually single-handed. Jacob emerged from his daydream only when his father shook him gently by the shoulder. He looked up to find his mother smiling at him. The audience had been rising from their seats, and a wooden collecting box was being passed around. At its approach, Jacob plunged his hand into his trouser pocket to pull out 2 copper pennies. Holding them on his palm, he looked questioningly at his mother. "That's your tram fare home, Jacob," she chided gently. "But can't I give it for China?" The boy shifted anxiously from foot to foot. "You could give your fares too, and we could walk home, couldn't we?" "It's pouring with rain, lad," said his father, "and we've got nearly 2 miles to go."
"But Papa," he pleaded, "we should try to help save China, shouldn't we?"
His mother reached out and brushed the fringe of fair hair from his eyes. The expression in them was eager, endlessly hopeful. "Jacob's right," she said, opening her own purse and dropping 3 pennies into the collecting box. "Our need is not as great as China's." On the way out of the mission hall, they passed close to the animated group of people pressing around the missionary speaker. He was bending over a box, putting away the Mandarin's gown and other Chinese curios that he had brought for display. Looking up expectantly, he caught Jacob staring at him, and their eyes met. Immediately, the face of the missionary broke into a broad smile, and one eye closed slowly in a conspiratorial wink. Jacob grinned shyly in return and rushed into the street, tugging a flat cap from his pocket. Taking the hands of both his parents, he hurried across the slippery cobblestones between them, oblivious to the heavy rain. Inspired anew by the intimacy of the missionary's wing, in his mind, he had already re-entered the mysterious mountains and dragon lairs of China. During the long, drenching walk home, he reveled in a giddy succession of blood-stirring adventures of the imagination. And by the time the family reached the door of their modest, terraced house, without his realizing it, a fierce spark had been ignited inside Jacob. It would smolder on almost unnoticed for several years before being fanned into the bright blaze of a conscious ambition. And the pursuit of that ambition, fired in a drab backstreet mission hall, would ultimately shape his fate and determine the course of his adult life. At that same hour, 7,000 miles away, in the real China, a faint breeze was nudging a canopied sampan across the sparkling waters of Nanhu Lake at Jiaxing, southwest of Shanghai. On board the 50-foot craft lounged a dozen young Chinese men who were pretending that they were there to enjoy the tranquil beauty of the placid, lotus-fringed lake. In the shade of the cocoa palm awning, they made a show of idly sipping wine from porcelain beakers and dabbing chopsticks at dishes of spiced Nanhu fish they had purchased from an itinerant lakeside food vendor. But whenever their boat drifted out of range of the other pleasure sampans plying the lake, sheafs of documents were quietly drawn out of scuffed satchels beneath their seats by each of the young men. Their bodies straightened. Their expressions became alert, and their false indolence evaporated in a moment as they began again to argue and debate with one another in low, passionate tones. They were dressed in well-worn gowns or tunics of a variety of native cloths that, along with their differing dialects, indicated that they had made the long journeys from widely separated cities. Shanghai, Peking, Changsha, Wuhan, Canton, Jinan. Their faces, intelligent, educated, in some cases scholarly, betrayed the common intellectual heritage they shared. Most were obviously the sons of mandarins, landlords, and other bourgeois families, and all were in their 20s or early 30s. Without exception, their eyes bore the bright gleam common to young men who imagine they have a vital mission in life to fulfill. One of the group, a tall, gaunt Hunanese, seemed to set himself apart. His pale blue gown was crumpled and creased, his thick black hair unwashed and far longer than any of the others, and this gave him an unkempt, gypsy-like air. Dirt was visible beneath his fingernails. His face bore a dark smudge on one cheek, and even when the discussion intensified, he continued to loll silently against the gunwale of the sampan, trailing one hand distractedly in the water. Whenever he turned his head to look at one of the speakers, however, the focus of his gaze was unusually sharp and penetrating, and from time to time, while still staring into the green waters of the lake, he shook his mane of hair dramatically, as though to express his pent-up disagreement with what was being proposed.
Comrade Mao Zedong, you've said almost nothing.
The note of reproof in the voice of the round-faced Chinese presiding over the meeting from the head of the narrow plank table was unmistakable as he addressed the reclining figure.
If we are to succeed here today at long last in our efforts to found a united Communist Party for all China, every delegate attending should make his views clearly known. So kindly tell us, Comrade Mao, Do we have your support for the majority proposal to base the party statutes on those of the experienced Russian Bolshevik Party or not?
The long-haired Hunanese continued peering silently into the lake for so long that the other delegates thought he was rudely declining to reply. Then he smote the surface of the water sharply with the palm of his hand and sat up, fixing his gaze intently on the man at the head of the table.
Comrade Cheng Huotao, I am already 27 years old. I cannot wait 100 years more to overthrow the militarists and foreign imperialists who have enslaved China for so long. I want action today. Tomorrow. I want to see things happening very soon with my own eyes.
He drew a long, slow breath, struggling openly to subdue the force of his long-repressed feelings.
My admiration for the revolution of the Russian Bolsheviks is boundless, but China isn't Russia. They urge us to organize the workers in our cities to overthrow capitalism and set up a dictatorship of the proletariat. But our country is so backward that we have comparatively few city workers at present. Are we forgetting that among every 100 Chinese, there are 80 peasants? Don't you see, from the very start, the burden of our revolution must be borne by all the people of China, not just a few. We are all impatient to hasten the revolution that will save our country, Comrade Mao, said the round-faced chairman quietly. But we must exercise caution at all times. Although they are small in number at present, city workers are likely to be more politically aware than our vastly more numerous peasants. And we shall gain the most benefit at present if we organize our new party on the already successful Bolshevik principles, and also affiliate ourselves with the Communist International. What's more, if we report regularly to Moscow on our progress, we shall receive guidance and support from men who have made a successful revolution in their own country 4 years ago. But above all else, as I have already said, we must remain cautious. The comrade chairman is right, interjected one of the other delegates. Have you forgotten so soon that this founding Congress itself almost ended in disaster in Shanghai because of our very lack of caution? If we had not been constantly vigilant since discovering that traitorous police informer in our midst, our secret meeting in that warehouse in that French concession would have been betrayed before we could make our escape. Our presence on this sampan in the middle of a quiet lake, far from prying ears and eyes, should remind us above all else that we must always be cautious and not impatient.
The chairman nodded his grateful appreciation of the speaker's support.
May we take it, then, that the delegate from Hunan now approves the proposal to follow the example of the Russian Bolsheviks and organize our party accordingly, starting in urban centers?
He asked quietly. For a moment, the young, untidy Hunanese hesitated. Then he relaxed and stretched his long body slowly along the length of the gunwale once more.
I approve the proposal, he said shortly, without looking up.
Then he added quietly,
for the time being, that is.
The chairman of the meeting briskly shuffled the papers in front of him, and in a low voice began to read out the previously prepared written drafts of the founding statutes for the Zhongguo Gongchandang, the Communist Party of China. When he had finished, the drone of discussion resumed. But the unkempt delegate from Hunan did not attempt to join in. Instead, he continued to lean over the side and drag his fingers idly in the water. The brooding expression returned to his face, and as the sampan drifted on toward the setting sun, he continued to gaze restlessly about himself, as though seeking inspiration in the surface clusters of red and white lotus flowers, the pine trees that marked the lake's shoreline, and in the distant, misty shadows of China's southern mountains. Part 1. The Marchers Gather, 1931. In 1931, China was politically dislocated and seething with unrest. Western nations were continuing to exercise a humiliating form of colonial rule over many treaty port areas that they had seized in the mid-19th century. And an unfinished revolution had deteriorated after two confused decades into a communist-nationalist civil war. The revolution of 1911 had been sparked, above all else, by the ever-increasing intrusion into China by foreign powers. This had proved a particularly traumatic experience for a proud nation possessed of 4,000 years of recorded history and a deep conviction of the inherent superiority of its civilization. China's very name, Zhongguo, meaning Middle Kingdom or Central Country, reflected this ancient sense of authority. And its emperors had been accustomed since earliest times to receive annual tribute of silver and other gifts from neighboring Asian countries. But neither the philosophies of China's great sages, the cultural refinements of its Mandarin scholars, nor its large armies could provide any defense against those Western nations who burst forth from Europe during the 19th century, newly strengthened by the Industrial Revolution, to colonize much of the rest of the world. China's gold, jade, silk, and tea provided irresistible commercial bait, and its massive population of 400 million, a quarter of mankind, constituted the biggest single potential market in the world. With their steel steamships, mass-manufactured weapons, railways, and telegraphs, the Europeans cowed backward nations on all continents. And by the end of the 19th century, exploitation of an enfeebled China had become a mad scramble among the colonial powers. Britain, which had first forced China to open its ports to foreign trade after the Opium War of 1840, had set up a colony proper in Hong Kong. Shanghai, Canton, and Tianjin became the other major foreign-ruled coastal enclaves where Europeans enjoyed the security and protection of their own national laws and police forces. Railway and mining concessions and other trading privileges were also extorted from China's helpless imperial governments. In addition, the many treaties imposed on Peking forced the Chinese to grant foreign evangelists wide-ranging rights. The number of missionaries entering the country increased rapidly in the wake of the colonialist penetration, and churches, schools, orphanages, and hospitals were set up both in the treaty ports and in many parts of the interior. The numbers of Chinese converted to Christianity always remained small in comparison with the missionary effort and the size of the population, but this did nothing to lessen the fervor of the missionaries themselves. Even the anti-foreign Boxer Rebellion of 1900, which resulted in the ritual massacre of many European missionaries and their wives and children, along with thousands of Chinese Christian converts, did not drive out the foreign evangelists. The overthrow of China's last emperor a few years later, in 1911, succeeded in ending more than 2,000 years of imperial rule. However, this Republican Revolution, led by Dr. Sun Yat-sen, was not able to restore China's pride and independence. Instead, it plunged the nation into a state of prolonged political turmoil. Outside the foreign-ruled treaty ports, power passed immediately to the remnants of the Imperial Army, whose commanders became feared regional warlords. Reactionary mandarins and feudal landowners, as a result, retained the same stranglehold on the people throughout China that they had held under the emperors. Sun Yat-sen's Kuomintang, or Nationalist Party, which had been founded in 1893, welcomed communists into its ranks, as well as all other nationalists. But it was unable to assert its authority because it lacked effective military forces. Close links were developed with Moscow, and in the early 1920s, the Kuomintang began training its own armies. After the death of Sun Yat-sen in 1925, however, his successor, Chiang Kai-shek, broke with the Russian Bolsheviks, drove out the communists who had founded their own party in 1921, and turned the Kuomintang into a right-wing movement. In 1927, Jiang finalized the breach by staging a brutal massacre of thousands of communist workers in Shanghai. The Kuomintang's own armies then swept northward to Peking, subduing or winning over the regional warlords one by one. And a triumphant proclamation was issued announcing that China had been unified under Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek. The authority of Jiang's government based in Nanjing was not accepted, however, by the communists. The bulk of them had already retreated deep into the mountainous rural regions of central and southern China to set up their own administrative areas, which they called Soviets. About 80% of China's population were virtually landless peasants, and in their Soviets, the communists were satisfying an age-old grievance by executing landlords and distributing their fields to those who toiled in them. As a result, peasant volunteers had been flocking to their banners, and large-scale civil war developed when Chiang Kai-shek moved his nationalist armies against these Soviets. But the communists, although inferior in numbers and arms, resisted stubbornly by means of skillful guerrilla war strategies. As 1931 dawned, none of today's perspectives was discernible amid the turmoil of the time. In particular, no hint of the strength and determination possessed by China's communists had been allowed to filter to the outside world through the nationalist military blockades. Consequently, China's gigantic stew of complex causes and ambitions continued to lure many white Western adventurers into its midst. Fortune seekers of every kind thronged the relatively safe treaty ports, fascinated by the opportunities and excitements that a great and ancient country in ferment presented. The braver ones occasionally ventured beyond the international concession areas, and among those who did, none showed more courage than the men and women who traveled deep into the dangerous heartlands of China without protection as missionaries. 1. Several hundred Bakhoi hogs imprisoned in willow twig cages on the open afterdeck of the Tomekumaru squealed with fright as the wind-lashed East China Sea buffeted the 10,000-ton Japanese freighter with gathering force. The ship was nearing the end of its 7-week voyage from Tilbury to Shanghai, and the cages had been stacked in layers 5 and 6 deep by coolies who had jog-trotted them to the wharves at Bakhoi, close to the Hainan Strait. Only narrow aisles had been left between the stacked cages, and ducks and barnyard fowl piled on top of them in smaller baskets were beginning to squawk anxiously in their turn as the wind rose. The clamor increased when a young Chinese man and woman, attired in smart Western clothes, paused in their stroll around the deck and walked in among the cages to talk casually with the grimy deck coolie tending the animals. A sallow-faced European who had been walking in the opposite direction stopped when he noticed the incongruously dressed Asians conversing together. Moving quickly into the lee of a suspended lifeboat, he continued to watch the little group discreetly from a position where he could not be seen. In his second-class cabin close beneath the stern, Jacob Kellner lay on his narrow bunk, reading a Chinese language primer, trying to ignore the noise of the frightened hogs and the constant clatter and thump of the vessel's rudder that penetrated the cabin's bulkheads. The boy whose imagination had been fired by a sunburned China missionary in a dismal church hall had grown into a tall, lean, serious-faced young man. At 20, Jacob was now well over 6 feet tall. His long, angular frame had yet to fill out, but his shoulders were broad and straight. His face was determined and strong-jawed. His short, neatly parted hair had retained the fairness inherited from his Swiss father, and the eager impetuosity that had led him to donate his tram fare to China 10 years before was still evident in the alertness of his expression. But the long voyage from Tilbury had already made him restless, and as
sample complete. Ready to continue?